Now, we turn to Deuteronomy today, Deuteronomy chapter 16. Now, in the early 1700s, a man named William Blackstone was born, and he had the benefit of good education and a good mind, and so he went to Oxford and took reading and a degree in law. And William Blackstone entered the bar and became moderately successful as a lawyer initially, but gained most of his wealth and prestige through administration. And what is to say is he was a lawyer, but he had a mind bent towards administration. And so he brought a new accounting system into the College of Oxford and allowed for the efficient and timely accounting of finances that not only saved the company money, but actually established and paved a way for its future. And it could be said that much of Oxford's current status financially was dependent on his good sense. At the same time, he was applying theories of the British Enlightenment to the law. And as he became more successful as a barrister, and in England, most people seem to be unaware of this, there are two types of lawyers in England. There are barristers and solicitors. Solicitors do law for you outside of the courtroom, and they can also help you get a barrister. But a barrister is the person who argues the law before the court. Here in the U.S., we don't have such distinctions. But William Blackstone became a barrister, and a very successful barrister. But also with that, he brought administration to the law, that he viewed the law not as a series of actions which would then be adjudicated as righteous or unrighteous, but he viewed the law as a holistic system in which rights and responsibilities therefore brought the law to bear upon a particular issue in a codified, organized, administrative sense, and so that the law could be categorized into different areas. It was predicated on the rights of man under a God. And so as William Blackstone began to lecture and write upon this, he wrote a book called Commentary on English Law, which proved to be incredibly successful. His first volumes and his second volumes actually made him a millionaire in today's dollars. Can you imagine becoming a millionaire because of your breakaway bestseller, Commentary on English Law? And he did, in fact. He actually gave a series of lectures that people would pay to attend, and it earned him the equivalent of $500,000 in today's dollars, just people wanting to hear him speak on the law. Now, it should be also said at this point, you'd think, man, he must be some kind of speaker. Well, actually, by all accounts, he wasn't much of a speaker. But the depth of mind and organization brought to the law made a huge difference. Now, the only reason we're talking about William Blackstone is because William Blackstone codified law under a series of principles in the mid-1700s. Well, why would that be important to us? What happened in the late 1700s? The U.S. actually broke away from England and created its own country. Well, guess who became the primer, the reading for American law, as well as the informer upon the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, as well as the Federalist Papers? It was William Blackstone. William Blackstone's books were the Bible of American law. And they were frequently quoted, almost at times exclusively quoted, in every Supreme Court decision from 1800 all the way to about 1930. And, of course, in 1930, things changed. Actually, in the first early 1900s is that people began to move towards progressivism. And so law was not based so much in the rights of man and responsibilities under an almighty, but rather that rights and responsibilities were given by government. That became the new thing. But Blackstone is famous for a quote, which is called Blackstone's Ratio. No surprise, as uncreative as the guy was, of course it became known as Blackstone's Ratio. Blackstone's Ratio is, it is better for 10 guilty to go free than for one person who is innocent to be punished. You've heard that, haven't you? It's actually a foundational point of American law, the presumption of innocence argument. Isn't that amazing? But what that was based in was simply this. Blackstone said, if virtue cannot be appealed to as a provision against punishment, then how could we ever make an argument that virtue is worthwhile? That's a good point, isn't it? And many of you, this becomes a timely argument because recently we appointed a Supreme Court justice to the Supreme Court, and it almost did not happen because what was absent from the argument was the presumption of innocence. Anybody notice that? That simply rumors were stated, statements were given, and yet there was no presumption of innocence. And I gave a brief elucidation upon it on a sermon in which I pointed out that which was compelling was being disregarded in favor of that which was credible was being disregarded on the basis of that which was compelling. Is that the stories of Judge Kavanaugh's guilt were more compelling than the stories of his innocence, which were established in credibility. And so the presumption of innocence was disregarded. Well, here we actually have that established as a part of Genesis 18. In Genesis 18, you don't need to turn there, but Abraham makes a presumption of innocence argument to God, who is judging Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham makes the point, would it not be better that the guilty, in essence, live in order that 50 righteous people be not destroyed? And then he argued down from there. And of course, at the end, Abraham lost that argument because they couldn't even come up with 10 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah. But Lot alone was saved with his family. But we do have this idea in the law that there is a presumption of innocence, and that when someone brings witness against another, there needs to be skin in the game or something on the line. And so we pick up with the Ten Commandments, which states rather blankly and without fanfare, you shall not bear false witness against a neighbor. What does that mean? What does it mean that you... Yes, David. Okay, you cannot make up lies about another person. That is considered a sin. Why would God give such a law in the Ten Commandments? I'm looking for the easy answer. Yes. Because people do. People make up stuff and just lie. And I know, I just grew up sheltered, and as broken as my childhood was, the idea of dishonesty about another person seemed just terrible. Right? Now, as a child, I lied with the best of them. You know? Yeah, my mom always said he would lie for no reason as a child, just make up stuff. but never about another person. That seemed cruel. Everybody has their line, you know. You talk to the heroin addict, and the heroin addict says, yes, I do heroin, but crack, man, that's for really messed up people, right? Well, yes, I was a liar. As a child, I was a liar. Many people still accuse me of lying. And that's because I make up stuff just to mess with them. I can't resist it. I do like pushing people's buttons for no reason, but I usually let them off the hook unless I forget, which has happened a couple of times, where I've told my wife something that was patently untrue. And then when she told it back to me as fact later, I'm like, what are you talking about? That's not true. She said, you told me that. I'm like, oh, terribly sorry. Yeah, but we have this issue. And folks, for those of you raised in the church, you may not realize this. And those of you who have been saved for a while, you may have forgotten this. But human beings maliciously speak about one another for personal gain or for cruelty all of the time. And when that is applied to the law, then what ensues is chaos. We have a perfect example of that within the Me Too movement of the last couple of years, which has shed light upon an injustice that people have been used and abused based in their own weaknesses, based in their own disposition, and based in the power of others. That absolutely happens, that people with power abuse those under them. That's why there's a whole section in the Old Testament dealing with that as well. But what has been stated by supporters of the Me Too movement is that, of course, some people who are not guilty will be punished under this movement. But for the sake of justice in the past, we must tolerate it. The only problem is that what you're saying is that it is better for 10 innocent people to be punished than for one guilty to go free. It is the reversal of Western law, which has been established within the rights of man under an almighty since long before America was even born. And we have watched it be undone just simply based in what, at the end of the day, has become an emotive argument rather than a reasoned argument. And folks, let me just take one more opportunity to hammer this home. If your relationships with people are rooted in your emotions, I would presume that you are on a bad footing. And actually, you might question whether those relationships are real at all. Because emotions change. They go up and down. They change with the wind. They actually even change with how much sleep you get and what you eat. Emotions are fickle things. And that's why every relationship in this world is rooted in obligation, moral obligation. That is the essence of love. And when God says, you shall not bear a false witness against a neighbor, what God is saying is, you owe every human being on the face of the planet the truth. Can you imagine? That's the standard. I owe this person the truth. Now, I do not owe them everything that I think and everything that I know. But I do owe that when I speak to them, I owe them the truth. When I speak about them, I owe them the truth. And isn't it amazing, even when we examine ourselves, how often we come to concrete resolutions about people that may not be true? And we may state those things to others, and they may not be true. And so the law in the Old Testament takes up this cause, and we'll pick up here in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18. You shall appoint for yourselves judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes. They shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort judgment, nor shall you be partial. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. What is this saying? What is the purpose of justice and the justice system? Well, ask a police officer. Ask a cop day. Tell me, what's the purpose of the justice system? Civil stability. How do you mean? Okay. All right, so there is no standard for right action without it, right? All right, so does that mean that every crime must be punished within the justice system? Okay, in reality, it is not possible that every crime be punished. So to what degree must crime be punished? Okay, according to what the law dictates, right? Okay. So, Tommy, on what basis would a law, would a crime not be punished? Okay, how do you mean justification? Okay, let's be clear. Not every homicide is a crime. Ah, okay, classified as a homicide. That we are on the right track. I'm so glad I asked a cop day, right? So, every person that dies is a homicide. But not all homicides are crime. It can be adjudicated as a righteous thing. Now, based in one example you gave is if it is in self-defense, that I was threatened with my life and so defended commiserately and ended another person's life. I have not done a crime. Let's also be clear. When I've killed a person in self-defense, I have not sinned. And there we step upon another field of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, excepting which, right? Accepting which, that your life is threatened and so you defend yourself and end another person's life. No sin has been committed. So on that case, the justice system does what? It affirms righteous action. Now, what other basis might not a crime be punished? And I'll go ahead and cut to the chase. What if there is not enough evidence that a crime is punishable. You know, here we come up against a crime and it looks like murder, but in the evidence, perhaps it is manslaughter, but perhaps not. Perhaps it's accidental. Perhaps it's self-defense. Bob, what if the law tells you to do murder? Oh my goodness, Bob, can you give me an example? Oh, that's not murder. Yeah, once again, if we are accepting, right? So, thou shalt not kill, accepting of which the state makes a judgment against a foreign power or against one of its citizenry that the citizen or foreign power is worthy of death, and then sends you out upon the mission to kill with extreme prejudice the offender. This is why executioners are not murderers. The executioner is only the sword of the state. And so in Romans 13, God affirms that the state is given the sword to operate against its citizenry and also to operate against foreign powers to which it has adjudicated guilt. And so it is not murder at all. You have not committed a sin. Not committed a sin. But here we have this issue, right? We have this issue. The presumption of innocence becomes very important. Because if we presume a person's innocence, then we are looking for evidence to establish guilt. Notice that the death of a person is not necessarily the adjudication that the state has something to do with it, or the state has to punish someone. Tommy, do people commit murders and get away with it? All the time. Well, not all the time, but frequently that happens. So what do we do with those murders? What do we do with the murder that cannot be caught? What do we do with the murder that cannot be solved? The FBI. I will state clear, that is a terrible answer. Terrible answer. David. You guys are such justice hounds. Oh my goodness. You know, I did find it interesting. There was a pastor down in Lancaster, I believe, a few years ago, who killed his wife and somehow covered up the murder. And then of course, he killed his second wife. And suddenly people went, hey, this looks suspicious. So I've tucked that away. You can get away maybe with the first murder. The second murder becomes problematic. Mylene, make a note. But yeah, there you go, right? What do we do, though? Do we sit there and look for justice, or is there a different thing at play? Well, notice here. You shall appoint for yourselves judges and officers in your own towns, which the Lord your God has given you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. Or, I can reinterpret there a little bit, righteous judgment or truthful judgment. That which is established in truth or evidentiary weight. They shall not distort justice. Notice the next line. You shall not be partial. What does that mean? You shall not distort justice. Up under that first point, you shall not be partial. What does that mean? Huh? Bias, okay. Anybody else? Tommy, you look like a guy who wants to say something. All right, so the standard is set and is followed throughout. That means that the rich do not gain an upper hand, the poor do not gain an upper hand, the insider does not gain an upper hand, the outsider does not gain an upper hand. Justice is blind. This is another pillar of the American system, that justice is to be blind. Does it work that way? Well, does it work that way? Tommy, ask a cop day. Does it work that way? Ah, to a point. To a point it does. Now, folks, I was talking to my friend in Africa a few weeks ago, and I shared with you that his driver had gotten shot. And so they went to the police to make a report, but they only made the report because it's the right thing to do. But he said with no sense of irony at all, he said, well, you know, in Africa, when a crime happens, it happens, but if you don't have money, nothing really gets done about it. That's not true here, is it? That actually in this country, this remarkable place, people with no power, no position, and even those who have negative power and negative position, that actually the rights against criminals are held equal to the rights of the law-abiding. And not only that, but I could be a criminal who Tommy has arrested 4 or 5 times. And I bet Tommy arrests people 4 or 5 times. And yet when someone operates against them, against the law, Tommy would pursue that crime and the justice system would pursue that crime. That if a robber was in fact robbed, the police would investigate the crime. Isn't that amazing? I don't think you guys are getting it. Do you realize the country that we live in? Where even the rights of those who have thrown away their rights are esteemed. Where even the criminal is defended. That's an amazing thing. Now, of course, if O.J. Simpson had not been wealthy, would he have gone to jail? You betcha. You betcha. Does justice get perverted by wealth and media? Sure, it does. But here's the point. It happens so rarely that we notice it. And so when God gives his people these rules, he's really counterculture. Think about the legal system of the ancient Near East, the legal systems of various governments and countries. These are places which many people point to. They point to Hammurabi's Code, for instance, and they say, look at the justice system within Hammurabi's Code. However, everybody knows, and everybody completely gets it, that really the law in Hammurabi's time, as well as Roman law in the first century, as well as the law of the Chens applied only and only to the citizens who existed at the upper end of society. Did the law really apply to a slave? Did the law really apply to the poor? Absolutely not. And that's why it's so counterculture for God to say in his word that, let's say we're going to tolerate slavery. And so a woman, the lowest level of right within society, a slave woman, a foreign woman who is in slavery and then sold into slavery, once she has been established as a wife, she has the ability to publicly upbraid her husband before the justice system with an Old Testament law. Do you realize how counterculture that is? And that foundation was what was, in essence, adopted within Blackstone's codification at the particular time of history where people were listening to the codification of law at the formation of this country. The providence of God, the hand of God, in establishing this place in which the legal system actually works or has worked, and there is a question about whether it will continue to work. There's a question. Now, I have been to several countries, and usually, admittedly, to bad countries. It just seems to be where we spend most of our mission effort, is in bad countries. Every country I have been to outside of America, the police officers are expected to make some portion of their income from bribery. Every country I've been to. Any particular reason why that would be the case? Yeah, this is one of my big complaints. Right? Karen has stepped right into it. I'm very angry with Karen now. Nah. A few years ago, I was watching a Pioneers Missions video, which was talking about the need for missions in the Islamic world. And the missionary on the video made an incredibly stupid statement. Unbelievably stupid. He said, terrorism is the handmaiden of poverty. That poverty, in essence, creates terrorism. Is that true? No, it's not. What creates terrorism? Poor ethic. It's like, well, you can't blame people for robbing liquor stores. I mean, after all, they're poor. Now, I want you to understand, I grew up poor. I grew up well below the poverty line in America. My family never took public assistance because we believed it to be a malum in se. And so, I grew up poor. So actually, it's one of the few areas I take personal offense. It's very difficult to offend me, but the idea that poor people can't be ethical because, after all, they're poor is the most elitist, snobbish statement that you could ever make. What do you mean poor people must rob liquor stores because they're poor? No, poor people rob liquor stores because they have no ethic. Criminality does not exist disproportionately within the black community in the U.S. because they're poor. It exists because there has been an erosion of ethic within the community. The reason that there are inner city slums and criminal parts of the country, not the result of poverty or even lack of education. That's another one that gets me. Oh, well, you can't blame them for robbing people. I mean, after all, they're uneducated. They're uneducated? They don't know that it's wrong to rob people? Why do they only do it in the dark when the police cannot see? I think they know that it's not right. You see, what God is doing here with His law is He is establishing that the law applies to all, and there is a presumption of innocence, but there is also within government, within the hand of the state, the moral obligation to apply that law equally to all people across the spectrum and to go counter to the culture or counter to human nature. What we see in other countries, and what we have seen historically in other countries, is the misapplication or the disproportionate application of the law based in wealth, position, or access to the inside. And so when God says, you shall not pervert justice, you shall not be partial, what He's saying is, the rich and the poor stand equal in both offense and affirmation to the law. And then He follows it by a second statement. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. That in essence, bribes remove the ability of the state to fulfill its obligation. So the question is, why do all of these countries fail? They do not fail on the basis of poverty or education. They do not fail on the basis of lack of infrastructure. They all fail on the basis of ethic. And this is the thing that is so ubiquitous, such a part of our background, such a part of our fabric, that we simply step over it. We miss it. And you know what? Here we are in Thanksgiving. A tremendous amount of thanks needs to be given. You live in a country which, for the most part, beyond the bounds of human nature, that if a crime is committed or you commit a crime, there is a fair degree of certainty that justice might be done. In other places in the world, and in most places in the world, that cannot be. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. And so, God says, I want you to understand something. Bribes pervert justice. Bribes blind. God had to instruct that because the human mind is able to justify a bribe. The human mind is able to justify why it can do this thing and still do its job. Now, I met a police officer in Northern Virginia, and she was Colombian by birth. She was from the nation of Colombia. Her father was a police officer, and he had, of course, supplemented his income with bribes. And she became a police officer in the United States. And guess what? She did not take bribes. Now, was that because she was better paid? Absolutely not. She didn't take bribes because she had learned that bribes disallow the righteous performance of her duty. Now, I always wondered, man, I mean, here you are, you're sitting there, you go to visit your dad in Colombia, and you know he's a crooked cop, and you're a cop. And you're sitting there across the table from that person. What does that do to you? I'd love to know. Jim, what would that do to you? If you were sitting there and your dad was a crooked police officer and you're a righteous police officer, what would that do to you? But what if you were a police officer and you're not a crooked police officer, but your dad... Your dad is a crooked police officer. What would that do to you?
I feel really horrible.
Yeah, it would. It would. There would be something deeply missing, wouldn't there?
Oh, yeah. May I go back to what you were saying before, though?
Sure.
Probably in this room, there's nobody besides Tommy and me who spent much time with you in a courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And when Tommy said they get away with murder all the time, that's because that's what he sees.
Right.
And they would raise the right hand to swear to tell the truth, and it meant nothing. They lied to the chief. The second thing is, if you have a judge who is prejudiced or doesn't like somebody or whatever, I knew one particular judge, I knew before I went to court whether I was going to be a guilty verdict or not guilty. It had nothing to do with the case. Nothing whatsoever. It was either politics or prejudice all the time. So Tommy and I have a different perspective than what everybody else does. When
sure. Sure.
That doesn't mean that we're not in the best country in the world. We are. And it's the best system. It's not perfect because it relies on people who are not perfect.
Right. Well, and actually, something has changed, hasn't it, Jim?
As far as what?
Well, you mentioned that everybody lies now. Has it always been that way? Sure. You know what's interesting? And it fleshes it out. People lie, right? People bear false witness. And yet somehow there are enough people in this country that we can call it the best system because there are enough people who tell the truth. There are enough people who are righteous in judgment. There are enough people who do the right thing. Isn't it crazy? Because we don't get it. We really don't. This area of the Ten Commandments, this area of God's commanding, is perhaps the most applicable because it, in essence, says, I owe every person with whom I speak and about whom I speak, truth and truthfulness. And this gets us back to our original point. What do we do with crimes that the justice system, in its best efforts, are unable to punish, are unable to adjudicate, are unable to find a solution for? The answer is, God exists. And someday, every man will stand before God, and everything hidden and unpunished will be punished and exposed. This was what actually gave me a great deal of relief in all of the years that I've been watching Bill and Hillary Clinton in the news. These are evil people. These are people who pervert justice. They have performed crimes. They have dispatched their duties with absolutely no regard. And I think that's fairly well established. I think people would agree. But it's okay. Those crimes will not be punished. These things will not be adjudicated here. But people will stand before God. And that actually brings me to a second point, is that I also must remember in my pointing of the finger at these people to whom we can validly point the finger, that I too will stand before the Lord. And a great many of my crimes have never been adjudicated, and I have never been punished for them. I've told you, I've run from the police successfully. I have never borne the brunt of those crimes, thankfully. So I can't quite, get there. But the last time I was pulled over, I did not run. I submitted to the law. Huh? And paid the price. But it wasn't that big a deal. And it made me feel much better because the girl that I was in court with had passed a stopped school bus and her whole life was ending. She was in terrible shape. But I think they beheaded her. I felt comparatively much better about it. Now, notice verse 20, justice and only justice you shall pursue. Notice that construction. Justice and only justice you shall pursue that you may live and possess the land. The continued existence of the nation, the continued prosperity of it, is based in both the obligation of the government and the limitation of the government, that not every crime will be punished, but also justice must be pursued. It will be imperfect. It will be limited. But to the degree that it is possible, the state, the government, the community is to pursue truth. Therefore, we have a system established that if we find a dead body and that dead body's position can be tied to another person, then that person potentially stands in danger or guilt of being pursued as a criminal, either a murderer or a person of manslaughter or a person of accidental killing. But the homicide is to be dealt with. However, truth and truth only is the pursuit. Therefore, if a dead body is found and we establish this crime must be paid for, and so we drag any person out of the crowd and put them to death for that crime, we have committed an injustice. We've punished someone for the crime, but it wasn't the person to whom the guilt was due. This is incredibly important. And I also want you to understand that, too, is counterculture. Recently, we have seen examples in other countries, and specifically Islamic countries, which are very focused on the punishment of crime. That if crime is committed, someone must pay the penalty for that crime. And so it is not unusual in other countries for a person who is minding their own business to be dragged from the crowd without any evidence at all, and to be punished for a crime that's been committed. And you think, well, that's irrational. No, it really happens. That really happens. And I remember talking to Sharon about New Guinea, and in New Guinea is that someone died, and it was established that a murder had been committed, and the murder had been committed by the pursuit of witchcraft. And so a person who had been established as being involved in witchcraft was dragged from the crowd and killed for it. Maybe that was Sharon or somebody else, but it was in New Guinea. That's not unusual. Makes you kind of thankful you live here, doesn't it? See, people either focus upon the guilt of someone for a crime, and so a crime must be punished, or the focus upon a person as to whether they can buy or establish by their own reputation their way out of trouble. We can point to examples of it in America. We can see it. But there is enough truth and truthfulness and the proper bounds and obligations of both rights and citizens and with government that justice or some reasonable facsimile can be established. That not every crime can be punished, but in the punishment of crime, justice can and is able to occur here. That's based in Old Testament law, translated through William Blackstone and established here in the American colonies, as well as Great Britain. It's true. And so we have that as our heritage. So we pick up then, again, in chapter 17, verse 6 and 7. On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people, so you shall purge the evil from your midst. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your courts, then you shall arise and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or to the judge who is in the office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. Notice here that it has established a hierarchy of judgment. And notice also that a rule is given. That one witness cannot hang a crime upon a person, but only by two or three. What do we draw from that? That people lie. Who said that? Very good. That people lie, but two or three witnesses would require a great deal of work to get the lies to agree. Notice, and if it is a capital crime, what then is required of the witnesses? Huh? They throw the first stones. Now think about that. And that might change some things, wouldn't it? That if the person who testified of a capital crime also had to participate in the execution. And there, what you're entrusting it is what? If Tommy commits a crime and Joe is the witness to that crime, and then Joe has to be the person who throws the switch on Tommy, what does that appeal to? David? The conscience. It appeals to the conscience that the person who makes an accusation is then responsible for the ramifications of that accusation. That also might be a good thing to incorporate in American jurisprudence. I'm not sure. Depends on how much Joe hates Tommy, doesn't it? Yeah. But there are two or three witnesses. And then, if it is too difficult Then it goes to the highest court. The highest court in the Old Testament was a Levitical priesthood. But notice here that he's just simply saying, if it's too difficult, does that still mean that every crime is punished? No. It just means that there is an order to do two things. One is to pursue justice so that, Tommy, how did you put it at the beginning? So that there's a general, a reasonable standard of what? Behavior, right? That a civil society operates. So there is enough pursuit of justice going on that it keeps people within the circle on some sort of straight and narrow, understanding that it's imperfect. The other is that it provides limitation upon the law to ascribe criminality and punishment to its citizenry. And so the presumption of innocence is also established. This is God's idea. And the only place in the world, in human history, that it has been pursued with any regularity is in the Western world. Europe and America. The only place in the world in human history where this, outside of the Old Testament, where this has been pursued with any regularity is here. And the rest of the world has run headlong against this. Now, here's the issue. This strikes you as common sense, doesn't it? Doesn't it? It strikes you as reasonable. God had to give instruction on it, folks. Because it turns out that sense is not common. And reason is in short supply. Any questions or comments? Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Well, it can. It can. You know, Israel was a monarchy, a theocratic monarchy, and yet that was established. You know, in places in the Islamic world where it's a theocracy, it doesn't happen, but it's possible. It is possible. Anybody else? Man, I just want to encourage you one more time. Folks, be thankful. Be thankful. We just live charmed, blessed, amazing lives. And many have suffered and sacrificed so that we can. So that we can actually take God's law in His Old Testament to His Old Testament people in a different dispensation of His working and apply it consistently and accurately and in a sense common sense wise. And it actually worked. That's an amazing thing. Let's pray. Father, we do just thank You for Your Word. And we know that You gave this to Your people because You loved them. And You did not want them to live in ignorance or magic or some sort of crazy oligarchy, but there was this check and balance, this reasonableness brought to bear, which You had to instruct because we don't master it easily. And so there has been a long history of consistency and wisdom and justice pursued. And so, Father, in those times when we crave for justice and we become appalled at injustice, we thank You for even the mindset that allows that possible. We have something to which to compare it. And so we ask also that You keep us patient, because someday all injustices will be dealt with, and all wrongs will be exposed. Everything which is evil will find its just reward and desert is the call of every man. And so, Father, we thank you for it. And it's in your name we pray. Amen. See you at church.